Welcome to the Bogosity Podcast for the 20th of April, 2015. The podcast that doesn't inhale.
Yeah.
And then falls over because it hasn't freezed. This is your host, Shane Killian. And joining me again this week is Travis Retriever. Travis, welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be back, Shane.
Also joining us for the very first time is Chris Hangartner. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
I'm 21 years old for starters, but also, I've kind of been a fan of your show for a while, ever since, a brony by the name of Blame the First, showed it to me. Yep. He's a really nice guy. And
I'd love to get him on someday.
Oh yeah. But before that, I've actually was also a pretty fan of liberty and libertarianism. I voted for Gary Johnson last election, and I was introduced to libertarianism actually while I was searching the web to make an argument, you know, against universal healthcare. And I came across John Stossel's episode where he criticized universal healthcare. And ever since then, I've been a student of liberty since then, although I come a long way. I will admit that in my youth, I shamefully was a socialist at one point in my youth.
Yeah.
But I recovered.
Yep. We're not going to blame you for being an idiot years ago, because we were all idiots years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I actually supported Obama during my younger years. I actually am literally embarrassed that I supported him.
I actually voted for him the first time.
Yeah.
We vote on things we don't remember.
Yeah, then 2012 comes along and I'm like, okay, so we're still in Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan, we still have high debt. This is what Bush did. I thought we were supposed to change.
If only someone had gotten on YouTube and warned you about it.
Oh, yeah.
All right, yeah. I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, I mean, the kicker is, if had Shane or someone else during that time said, hey, Tribe, you know, Obama voted for the bailouts, you know that, right? And I would have said, nope, gone, not voting for Obama. Screw that.
Yeah, I mean, I had a whole video where I went through all of that.
Son of a bae. Jeez.
I didn't even know about Ron Paul till 2011, actually, which I'm ashamed of. Really nice guy, which his son didn't, would have turned out the same. I have very mixed opinions about Rand Paul. On one hand, you know, he does have some good ideas, but he's just too afraid of upsetting his GOP friends.
Okay, one more announcement before we get going. Our friend and occasional co-host Tim Dyson, a.k.a. Lord T. Hawkeye, now has a Patreon account to raise money for his online webcomic Playtime. So if you've seen that and like it, or even if you just like his videos or appearances on this podcast, why don't you go show him some love?
Good luck to him, because I'm working on a comic myself.
Yeah, it's good. I've been following it.
Oh, yeah, I checked it out on DeviantArt. It's actually really good.
Okay, let's manhandle the news of the bogus. And our first story is a confluence of two issues we've been covering. One is the erosion of freedom of speech and open debate on college campuses, and the other is the tendency of modern pseudo-feminist social justice warriors to disempower women and force everyone else to coddle to their weaknesses.
Like always.
Yeah. So this was at Northwestern University. Media studies professor Laura Kipnis wrote a column where she talked about the changes that NU was making to their rules, and she says these rules are actually anti-feminist, infantilizing, and contributing to a culture of fear. Quote, the feminism I identified with as a student stressed independence and resilience. In the intervening years, the climate of sanctimony about student vulnerability has grown too thick to penetrate. No one dares question it, lest you're labeled anti-feminist, or worse, a sex criminal. I asked someone on our faculty senate if there had been any pushback when the administration presented the new consensual relations policy. His own view was that the existing sexual harassment policy already protected students from coercion in a hostile environment. The new rules infantilized students and presumed the guilt of professors. When I asked if I could quote him, he begged for anonymity, fearing vilification from his colleagues, and apparently his fears were well-founded because as soon as she published this, students started protesting and marching and saying that they were, quote, toxic ideas because they have no place here.
Wow. Yeah, college campuses, the quote-unquote place of ideas and information. Not anymore.
No.
And people wonder why I was so glad to be done with that part of my life when I graduated college. I can see the writing in the wall. I'm not blind.
Oh, yeah. You know what this kind of reminds me of? This reminds me of that one incident that happened a few years ago. I don't remember the exact position, but there was that university professor who was answering questions about why women and men were taking different roles in the college, and he stated that one of the reasons might just be be psychological differences between men and women, but we need more research. And he was hated for that to the point where he was forced to quit.
Yeah.
I just don't even have words for it anymore. It's just so stupid, you know?
So two students filed complaints against her, and they alleged that there were inaccuracies in her essay. But the thing is, they lodged the complaints with the university's Title IX coordinator, and that's who you talk to when you're experiencing sexual harassment in a hostile work environment. So even if they were true and she said things that were factually incorrect, it's just ridiculous to call that sexual harassment.
Mama pronoun shit lord.
Oh yeah, that's another thing that's so vague, the sexual harassment laws, you know, I mean, it's like, you know,
pretty much.
I mean, in some places you can actually get in serious trouble just for calling girls you guys.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I
don't know how it is in most of the country, but around here, guys has always been kind of gender neutral.
Yeah, same here. When I go up to girls and say, "Hey guys, what you doing?" They know I'm referring to them, you know. They also want to ban words like bossy. It's like,
"Oh god."
Oh, that's typically gender neutral because a boss could be of any gender. Heck, when I worked at Walmart, a lot of my bosses were female.
It's probably only sexist when you say a woman is bossy.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
It's only sexist if a man does it to a woman.
Of course.
And there's another example from Drexel University, Professor Lisa McElroy. Now, she made a huge mistake. This was bad. She sent her students an email with links for suggested reading. Unfortunately, she accidentally pasted in a porn link by mistake.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's bad. Oh, that's embarrassing. You know, I can see she should be made to apologize and maybe get a slap on the wrist or whatever.
Yeah.
But once again, the Title IX coordinator was brought in. She was placed on leave pending the results of an investigation.
Yeah, you're right. There's a huge look, understandably, she needs, you know, to take responsibility, but there's a huge difference between accidentally posting it and deliberately posting it, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, if this was an isolated, I mean, I could see if it keeps happening and it's like a pattern, that's one thing. But if it just one isolated incident of, you know, someone going, oops, that was the wrong thing.
Yeah, we live in a very overreactive society today.
Especially when it comes to sex.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like even I said on the Vagocity forums, it's like, I mean, when I saw this one video talking about covered alien CGI boobs, it's like, okay, how sexually repressed do you have to be to consider that porn?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah, that's especially true with games. You know, a lot of games are coming under flack, you know, for portraying women, you know, who are clothed, although they're a little bit skimpy, but it's not really porn or anything, but they say, oh, it's porn.
Well, Tamara Tabo of Above the Law had some pretty good, interesting points about this McElroy case. Quote, Lisa McElroy probably did not intend to create a hostile environment for anyone. She may not have actually offended most of her students. Common sense and compassion will probably lead to a quiet resolution to the case. I hope so. But what if Lisa McElroy were a man? Would observers be as quick to give the benefit of the doubt? If a male professor foisted anal bead porn on an unsuspecting class of students, would we wonder, even if just a little bit longer, if he meant to do it? Would we be as forgiving, even if we concluded that the porn link was a terrible mistake? Would people argue that he created a hostile environment for his female students no matter what? There is a terrible irony that laws and policies created to prevent gender discrimination can treat members of one gender differently and unfairly.
It's like Stefan Molyneux, Lord Hawkeye, and a bunch of others have said, if you use force, i.e. government, to accomplish your goals, you will get the opposite of what you want. Always.
So she also says, quote, as a university employee, my personal experience with Title IX has been discouraging, frustrating, alienating. I've been recruited to join complaints against male colleagues, most recently against someone with whom I was friends outside of our workplace. I have, when I refused to be a complainant, been interviewed as a witness. I have, when interviewed as a witness, been grilled over a multitude of conversations and social interactions that took place away from campus in the company of adults that I never expected that I would one day have to explain in a formal setting.
Wow. That is just terrible. I hate it when people do that. They judge your professional career based on something that you did, you know, in your private life. You know, it's like, your private life and your professional life are two different things.
Made even worse by the fact that I thought most universities were supposed to lean towards being liberal. And I thought, funny, I thought separating private and personal life like that, I thought that was something that liberals were for.
Which liberals are you talking about?
I thought in general.
Because I don't know any of them like that. They're all like God. This. That's what the progressive movement has been about since the very start.
Of course.
Well, I'm a liberal, but I'm a classical liberal.
Well, yeah, okay, classical.
Well, at least the ones that I used to associate with early as a teen, but, you know, apparently, yeah, freedom for me, but not for they.
Exactly.
It's the order of the day for them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people who argue, all, you know, college censorship and stuff, well, no, this has been the order of the day for, like you said, for decades, if not over a century now. At least since the start of the progressive movement, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, it's just bogus. I mean, there was an actual incident, you know, where some students, you know, were holding a pro-life rally because they were anti-abortion and all that, and you know, they weren't, you know, I mean, I kind of disagree with them, but they weren't being violent or anything. It was just a peaceful protest, and a teacher and several other students came up, grabbed their poster away, and assaulted them, you know, and from what I heard, the people who grabbed them, you know, called them terrorists and all that, and it's just like, look, if you disagree with them, that's fine, but you know. Debate with them, you know, have an honest, smart intellectual debate. Don't assault them, you know.
Yeah, it's like I disagree with basically everything the Westboro Baptist Church has ever said. But as far as I know, they haven't used anything other than just their freedom of speech to do what they do. And in that, I think they're much better people than the ones we're talking about here who are trying to get government to shut them down.
Pretty much.
Say, if you're tired of the promos in this podcast, well, the patrons got it early and with no ads or promos. Just go to patreon.bogosity.tv and donate at any level. History is written by the winners, and so apparently is economics. That's why there's libertyclassroom.com. Probably the best single learning resource for history and economics on the web, libertyclassroom.com teaches U.S. history, Western Civ, and economics from actual university professors. There's lots of free material to get you started, including introductory lectures on all these subjects. And when you sign up, you get the full site's content for just $99 a year, less than the price of 2 cups of coffee a month. And if you type in the promo code BOGOSITY in all caps, you'll get your first year for just $88. Lectures are available in both video and audio format, so you can watch or listen to them on your computer, your phone or tablet, or in your car. Learn at your own pace about the subjects you're interested in and become a more effective debater. You'll also get access to lots of supplemental materials and even the professors themselves via the discussion forum and even live video chats. Inform yourself against the myths and propaganda of our society. Visit libertyclassroom.com. Okay, some good news now. This time for both people fighting patent trolls and people making podcasts just like this one. Our old friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation made arguments that caused the U.S. Patent Office to invalidate the podcasting patent that this one patent troll has been going around to all sorts of podcasts like ones produced by Adam Carolla and people like that. This isn't even a company that does podcasts. They're just a company. They form the company specifically to buy the patent. And then once they buy the patent, they go out and sue everyone for breaching it.
Oh, yeah, that's a common practice. Some people do.
So, EFF staff attorney Daniel Nazer, who has the best title in the world, he holds the Mark Cuban Chair to Eliminate Stupid Patents.
that is a name full of win.
He said, quote, "We're grateful for all the support of our challenge to this patent. Today is a big victory for the podcasting community. We're glad the Patent Office recognized what we all knew. Podcasting had been around for many years, and this company does not own it."
True that.
Mm-hmm. And that company is Personal Audio LLC. And like I said, I don't think they actually produce anything. I think they just bought the patent, so.
Yet another real-world example of why IP is bullshit.
Well, yeah, and it's just the fact that patents were made to protect inventions. Is podcasting really an invention? There's nothing really in here that distinguishes inventing from engineering. When you take things that already exist and put them together in a different way to solve a problem, that's engineering. And someone else trying to solve the same problem might come up with something very similar, but if you run off to the patent office, then you're actually stopping innovation in its tracks.
Oh yeah, our patent laws are so screwed up. There's actual cases of some companies, you know, patenting, you know, natural chemicals and genes, you know, that are already in the natural environment. They didn't create them. They've been here forever. And there was even one famous lawyer who, out of a joke, you know, filed a patent for a new for his child for a new method of swinging in on a swing set.
Oh, yeah.
I actually saw that on crack.com. And another guy, if you can believe it, actually patented a stick as a something you throw to your dog.
One guy actually patented, I kid you not, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with the crust cut off.
Wow.
It's patented.
Yeah.
All sorts of crazy patents. Fortunately, the Supreme Court said that the whole thing about gene patenting, if it's a natural gene that occurs in nature and not one you invented, you can patent it, so at least they went that far.
I mean, I can understand if it was something that you engineered or made in a lab that wasn't there before. That I could kind of sort of understand, but I mean, some that's already there, just that doesn't make any sense.
Yep. And going back to that, I've actually met, you know, some statists, who have said, you know, patents are the reason why capitalism can't work. But, you know, there was a really good quote where I don't know if it was Dyson or Steven who said this, but it was Adam Kokesh. He was doing a debunking of top 10, you know, questions libertarians can't answer. And when one person brought up, what about all these ridiculous patents on genes and all that? His answer was, who gives them the patents?
Oh.
Yeah. The telescope. The microscope. The printing press. And probably a bunch of more from that era that I could think of. Just so many inventions.
Vitamins. A bunch of vaccines, like the polio vaccine.
All sorts of things were not patented. We're not patented. And couldn't be patented.
And even from an economic calculation standpoint, instead of actually rewarding people for getting, you know, like a product or innovation or something that gives them profit, this seems to be something that actually punishes and stops it. That is, you know, you have that one person who gets to the patent office first, and then it stops everyone else from innovating around that.
Well, and the claim they use is completely invalid because they say, well, if, you know, I get this invention, and I start selling it, someone else can just copy my invention. No, you can't just copy an invention. You have to reverse engineer it, and the cost of doing all the R&D to reverse engineer it and figure everything out is pretty much what you paid initially to invent the thing, if not more.
And they might try to weasel around that and say, oh, well, it's actually like 65 or whatever percent. Yeah, and not actually. Here's the missing part of that. Well, one, you have to hire actual scientists and engineers like me to actually do into that stuff. And fun fact, you have to actually keep us like up to date in our skills and knowledge, which generally requires subscriptions and other and furthering education, etc., which usually cost a fair chunk of change.
Bogosity.tv and all of its services are hosted at GoDaddy. I've been very satisfied with GoDaddy's services and their wonderful 24/7 customer support for over 10 years now. So I'm happy to be able to give you this special offer. Just sign up for any new domain, web hosting, email, or other service and get 35% off with the code WOWNOBOGON. That's WOWNOBOGON. Because there's nothing bogus about these savings on quality internet hosting. Just go to GoDaddy.com and use the code WOWNOBOGON. So we've been covering for a while the privacy concerns surrounding the NSA spying programs, but now Robert Graham of Errata Security, and we've used material for him before, and he's someone I've admired for years, but he's saying that the NSA are not the ones we should be focusing on. Quote, Snowden is my hero, but here's the thing. The NSA is the least of our worries. Firstly, their attention is foreign, not domestic. Second, they are relatively uncorrupt. Our attention should be focused on the corrupt domestic law enforcement agencies like the ATF, DEA, and FBI.
And of course, the key word there is relatively.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like saying, well, yeah, but he's the least muscular competitor at the Mr. Olympia. I mean, come on, that's still pretty freaking muscular.
Yep, they all have the same boss, so...
Yeah, but his point is, quote, the issue is private information exposed to the FBI and other domestic agencies. It's the FBI, ATF, or DEA that will come break down your door and arrest you, not the NSA.
Which to me kind of begs the question of... Well, in this case, who's responsible? The person who gave them the information, or the person who uses it to bust you down your door and shoot your dog or whatever?
Well, I mean, that's just the thing. A lot of them are getting this information from the NSA.
Yeah, the NSA may not have an armed branch, but still, if they have information that they think might be a threat, they can easily give it to the FBI or ATF, and they can send the guys with the guns to your house to kill your dog and traumatize your children.
Yeah. I also think he's being a bit short-sighted about this whole thing about the NSA Their attention is foreign, not domestic. I mean, ultimately, we're talking about an imaginary line drawn on a map by politicians. I mean, the people on the other side of that line have the same rights to privacy and dignity that we do. And you can't be sure, even if you're in the U.S. and you're visiting a U.S. website, you can't be sure that your traffic isn't going out of the country. Because it's going to be passed from router to router to router to get there, and the routers are going to get together and try to figure out the best route to get there. They have a number of criteria they use to do that, but the country the router is in is not one of them. So if it hops a router into Canada and then comes right back, the NSA could still get it.
Oh, yeah, and not to mention, the NSA thinks, you know, thinks that there's foreign threats everywhere. You know, one of my friends, you know, who used to serve in the military says, you know, America is currently going through what he likes to call the sand scare. It's like the Red Scare, only instead of going after a suspected communist, they go after suspected terrorists.
Yeah, pretty much. Basically, replace the word communist with terrorist, and you've got the exact same rhetoric way back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember the Cold War and all the rhetoric we were given. It's exactly the same.
Yeah, back when even just lifting a finger to criticize the U.S. government, like if you said, I don't think we should be, you know, getting involved, you know, in South American affairs, they'd be like, you don't want those communists to win now, do you? Now, don't get me wrong, I hate communism, but, you know, our actions that we did during the Cold War wasn't helping.
As Dave would probably say if he were here, you don't defeat the problem of assholes by being an even bigger asshole, or you just make them look like a mere rectum.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, even though I'm pretty much disagreeing with how far Graham has gone here, he does have a point. Instead of focusing solely on the NSA, we should also focus on these other organizations like the CIA.
Oh, yeah.
For example, even a decade before the September 11th attacks, the U.S. government was harvesting calls and harvesting the metadata through the Justice Department and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Basically,
one more reason in the drug war.
Yeah, of course, in the name of the drug war. Now it's in the name of terrorism, but again, it's the same thing with a different name.
Wow.
And pretty much any call from the USA that went to as many as 116 different countries was monitored to look for links to drug trafficking.
Oh, yeah.
And these drug cartels.
So why do I get this weird impression that they were doing this even before the drug? Before that, like, oh, well, but you don't want them to be coming with communists or whatever. And before that, I'm sure it was, oh, but what if they're Nazi sympathizers or something?
Oh, yeah, they did that back in World War II, actually. Believe it or not, you know, wiretapping and all that. They actually did that back in World War II. In fact, famously, one of the Kennedys, I don't know if it was JFK or whatnot, but one of the Kennedys was having a relationship with a famous German actress who happened to have, like, a couple of boyfriends who used to be in the Nazi party. So they monitored him. And from what I heard, according to this documentary, the FBI literally had, like, hours upon hours of basically just sex tapes of Kennedy with his girlfriend.
Well, one of the reasons for the Telecommunications Act was to make sure that when you're communicating over telecommunications line, the police or whoever can tap into it. You know, like the thing you see, you know, the kidnapper calls and, you know, the person answers and gets the instructions. And then the guys are sitting there with all their equipment, twiddling dials and everything, to listening in on and figure out where it's coming from. The Telecommunications Act was written so that they specifically could listen in on it and do it. Remember that the next time someone talks about net neutrality and why we should apply the Telecommunications Act to the internet.
Oh, yeah, that I do not want to think of a society like that, you know.
And of course, all the people I know, one even a defense engineer for the computer engineer and defense engineer for the military, who basically seems to think that the FCC just marching right in like it did is apparently a good thing.
Yeah.
Whereas I guarantee if it were something, say, someone he doesn't like, i.e. Bush, or to pull that kind of crap, he'd flip out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, getting back to this, you have people like Robert Mueller, the former FBI boss, one of our favorite senators, Dianne Feinstein, and NSA supporter, Stuart Baker. They're all talking about how, you know, if we only had this phone collection program before 9/11, we could have stopped the attacks. Well, they did have this. The DEA had its own database of all of the phone call metadata, all of the calls going outside or coming into the country since 1992 that we know of, maybe even earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me of the TSA. Number of terrorists they've stopped. Zero. Funny how that works.
Zero, yeah.
Yeah, I hate politicians that always say that, always say, oh, if only we did this, this would have prevented. It reminds me of that one quote you said a long time ago, Shane, where it's like, yeah, and the patient didn't get any better because we didn't apply enough leeches.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yep.
It's just like, you know, the school system. Oh, we need to pay more money for education. Well, the money for education keeps going up, and the scores stay the same.
Bogosity.tv is a participant in the Amazon Services LLC Associates Program, an affiliate advertising program designed to provide the means for sites to earn advertising fees by advertising and linking to Amazon.com. Just clear your cookies and go to Amazon.bogosity.tv, or check the right-hand side of the podcast page for Amazon's best deals, including the deal of the day and limited-time lightning deals on all sorts of great products. So next time you buy online, go to Amazon.bogosity.tv.
So what do you do if you're a government and security researchers point out major flaws with your voting machines? Well, if you're like the government of New South Wales and Australia, you kill the messengers. And this is a problem with their internet voting system, which may have left as many as 66,000 votes vulnerable to both interception and manipulation in an actual election.
Doesn't surprise me.
But you see, your vote counts and matters.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a flaw that we talked about, I think, last month or so when it came out, that's been patched, called Freak. And just to recap, back in the 90s, the U.S. federal government decided that encryption was a munition and that strong encryption couldn't be exported, and so you had to use a weak RSA key called RSA Export when you're communicating overseas. Even though they realized what a ridiculous thing that was and dropped it before the turn of the century, those export keys were still around as recently as a couple months ago, and if you didn't update your system and get rid of those keys, a man in the middle could actually force, like, you and your bank's web server to drop back to this weaker form of encryption that, I mean, you've got to think about it. If the NSA supercomputers could crack it in 1995, you know, your computer could easily do it now. So this was a big flaw.
Oh, yeah.
So, government logic. Because apparently math is the same as a gun.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can stop bad guys from using math the way you can using a gun, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, in one of the articles you posted, there was even one guy who suggested that the government just flat-out ban encryption except for government use.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, how are you going to... Because what qualifies as encryption, you know?
Yeah, our next story is going to get into that, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's like even me and Shane, and I think possibly Dave or someone else discussed, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like, folks, this stuff, I mean, this computer stuff they're talking about, it's just math. It works the same for the bad guys as well as good guys. You know, I mean, get over it.
Yeah, and it doesn't care if you have a warrant or not.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this comes from the Chief Information Officer of the Electoral Commission, Ian Brightwell. He acknowledges that this is an error, but he attacks the people who revealed it as being part of, quote, well-funded, well-managed anti-internet voting lobby groups.
Oh, it was those goddamn Koch brothers that sabotaged our plan. Or I don't know what the Australians blame when something doesn't go wrong. I know in America they blame it on the Kochs, and the UK they blame it on the Tories, but I don't know what they blame it in Australia.
Well, don't forget about Monsanto. Lots of Monsanto.
Yeah.
And these experts, by the way, were Professor J. Alex Halderman of Michigan and Vanessa Teague of the University of Melbourne. And the lobbying group he's talking about is apparently verifiedvoting.org, and they're both advisory board members. And Verified Voting said, quote, current systems lack auditability. There's no way to independently confirm their correct functioning and that the outcomes accurately reflect the will of the voters while maintaining voter privacy and the secret ballot. And Verified Voting Foundation President Pamela Smith wrote this whole big response to Brightwell, where she said, quote, had these experts not made their findings public, it is impossible to know how many more voters could have been exposed, and every voter would have reason to doubt that his or her vote had been counted as cast. Yet instead of thanking Drs. Halderman and Teague for their discovery, you chose to question their motives and their association with Verified Voting. As the president of Verified Voting, I'd like to clarify a few things. Doctors Halderman and Teague serve in a voluntary capacity on the advisory board of verified voting. They may advise us when we ask for advice. We lean on them for advice and counsel because of their internationally recognized technical skill and their expertise in computer network security, cryptography, and election technology. They do not direct policy for the organization, nor do they receive direction from the organization. Although Verified Voting would have been proud to have sponsored this excellent work, Drs. Halderman and Teague undertook their study of iVote security flaws independently of our organization. We learned about this work only after you did.
Yeah, but to the government, it doesn't matter. Oh, if you did it for a private organization, there must be money involved, even though privately owned does not mean it's for profit, you know. It just means a person or an individual or a group of individuals own, you know, the shares and all that, you know. Try going to business school, people. Try going to business school.
And even then, I'm sorry, but anyone who thinks government isn't for profit...
Oh, yeah.
Hasn't been paying attention.
Has not been paying attention. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, I still remember that one bit where it showed that government workers, even if it's for the exact same field, I think it was after you include benefits, something like 50% more than their private counterparts.
Oh, yeah. But I'm right, though. You know, the South Wales government, that's just stupid. Now, look, again, as I said earlier, I'm not a tech guy. I barely know anything about encryption. But if I'm like a leader and I'm in charge of this and someone tells me that my encryption's not perfect, I'm going to go for help. I would have asked for someone, okay, what's wrong with our encryption? You know, if I don't have the knowledge, I'll go to an expert, you know, but these people are just saying, oh, it works just fine. It's you who's the problem, you know. You can't live life like that, you know.
Yes, but you see, they would have to be rational and thinking people to do that, and they're in government, yeah. So that's not the case. Quote erat demonstratum.
Yeah.
Well, and Smith even quotes the National Institute for Standards and Technology in the U.S., as well as the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, basically saying all the reasons why it is impossible to have internet voting be secure. We just do not know how to do that at this time. The best experts in the world cannot help you there.
Well, okay, yeah, that just shows flat-out incompetence. Yeah, I mean, many computer companies are working on this problem right now, and they've actually got some pretty good security modules, but the government's saying, nope, it can't be done.
Well, because it pretty much can't. This is a really, really, really difficult problem. How would you just make sure that the actual flesh-and-blood person at the computer is who they say they are and is a registered voter in that state or that district or whatever? You know, you think people complaining about the voter ID cards, you think that was bad. You know, imagine having to have some sort of thing that will completely and positively identify you online in order to vote. Think of what the privacy advocates would say about that.
And since it's government we're talking about, you know, it's only a matter of time if they were to come up with something like that before they have it be a normal thing for the rest of online as well. Just like I think it is, what is it like for, I think, South Korea even? Yeah.
Yeah, even though I haven't voted in a long time, I'm always nervous with voting because I'm always afraid, you know, what's gonna happen because votes can be manipulated. I mean, a good example would be look how they treated Ron Paul. You know, I mean, when Mitt Romney got chosen, I think the Republicans claimed, oh well, he didn't get enough, you know, votes or whatnot. But there were plenty of people that showed that Ron Paul had plenty of them, but the GOP deliberately, you know, undercounted them. So
they didn't count them at all.
Yeah.
Their official account was zero votes for Ron Paul.
Oh, yeah, you know.
There's a quote attributed to, I think, Joseph Stalin that says, the people who vote decide nothing. The person who counts the votes decides everything.
Oh, yeah.
And back home, even the non-internet voting machines in Virginia were shown to have serious security flaws. And, I mean, if you know anything about computer security, I'm going to try to explain to you how immense fail this is. This was in the state of Virginia, which was using these machines up until last Tuesday, which have been dubbed the worst voting machine in the U.S. It can be compromised by someone out in the parking lot with a laptop and a wireless card, some free software, and about 3 minutes of time.
Pathetic.
Oh, yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. I saw a whole news story on that one time.
Well, what had happened was some of these machines had crashed, and they wanted to do an audit to figure out what was going on. Why were they crashing? Why were they so unreliable? They couldn't figure out why it crashed, but in the process, they found all sorts of serious problems, not the least of which were their passwords. The Windows Administrator account password was admin.
Man, that's
Hold on, hold on, hold on. The Wi-Fi password was ABCDE.
Okay, seriously, that's some damn, like, someone's clueless grandmother level of computer fail there. I'm sorry.
And the database password was Shoop, which was the name of the company that had previously did the voting machines.
Boo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Not even pro tip, but basic tip with this stuff. Don't use the default password, you morons. Come on.
Never use the defaults. That's a big thing. But they also, and my jaw hit the floor when I saw this, the Wi-Fi network was secured with WEP, the Wired Equivalency Protocol, which was broken, I think, about 50 nanoseconds before it was released.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, just to try and quickly explain, if you've seen my videos on encryption, I have a whole playlist of those on my channel. You know about the one-time pad. The idea is you take a random string, and then you take your text, and you use a logical function called XOR, and it scrambles it up, and it absolutely cannot be descrambled ever without that same pad, and you XOR it again and you get it back. And I don't mean like it would take you trillions of years. No, infinity years would not be enough.
Did you say this was WPA or something?
WEP.
WEP.
Ah. Yeah. WPA2 is what you should be using. WPA is still good if you don't have WPA2, but you should be using WPA2. But don't ever use WEP, and I don't think routers have even been made with WEP in years.
Yeah.
So unless you have an old one, I don't think it's... Great. But anyway, so what they did was they used a stream cipher called RC4, which is exactly a good one for the time, what they should have used. And so it's making all these random numbers, and all of the stuff like the WEP password and some other stuff, like I think the date and time that the session started and maybe the client's MAC address and stuff like that. Things to make it unique to that session were used to seed the random numbers. So you got a list of random numbers that was unique to that connection. And that really sounds like it's completely unassailable. Well, they made one mistake. In order to verify the encryption, the Wi-Fi router sends just a piece of text, just randomly generated, just whatever, and says, encrypt this. The client encrypts it and sends it back, and it goes, okay, well, you encrypted it okay. The problem is someone snooping on the line gets both the unencrypted text and the encrypted text. All they have to do is use that same simple XOR function, and they get that portion of the random number string. And the way random number generators work is the random numbers that you're using are fed back in for the next random number, then that one's fed back in for the next, and so on. And, I mean, you can just instantly get everything you need. If as long as you can catch that initial handshake, you've got everything you need to decrypt that conversation. And you can even work backwards to figure out. Because, like, the other thing is stuff like the date and time it started and back address, things that people are going to see on the wire, because they have to be able to see that before they encrypt it. You just work backwards from that, and you can get the password. It is so easy to crack. Takes about 3 minutes. You just sit outside with your laptop and free software.
So basically even me and Chris could do that.
Oh, yeah.
If you found a how-to online that would take you step-by-step, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and people need to take this seriously, because actually a couple weeks ago I had a scare with hacking, because I was on a website called FimFiction, and I was posting a review for the latest My Little Pony episode. Yeah, I'm a brony, deal with it. What happened was that shortly after I posted the review, a friend of mine alerted me saying, hey, Chris, have you checked your review yet? And I'm like, why? Because I think someone breached into it. Well, why is that? Why is that? And then I noticed it wasn't working. There was some video on it of some sort that wasn't the original video that I posted on it. And it had some, I didn't see it, but apparently someone told me it was some random video, you know, glorifying Karl Marx or whatnot, because I'm a staunch anti-communist. And and finally I had one of my friends, you know, who knew a thing or two about computers, you know, took a look and he said, yeah, someone broke into your account. And that was just scary. I was going over because here's the thing. People say, well, it's just a My Little Pony fanfic website. Well, here's the thing. I signed into it using my Gmail account. So I had to go to my Gmail, make sure everything was okay there, change the password and everything. It was just horrendous, you know. And here's the thing. I was using, you know, a relatively strong password, but it wasn't good enough, you know. you know, I don't do this anymore. So anyone listening to this, don't try to hack me. But what I used to do is I would take like a really complex, you know, foreign language or language. Then I would use a system of numbers, but someone cracked into it. So now I use a password generator now.
I recommend LastPass. Yeah, randomly generate all your passwords.
But yeah, my experience does demonstrate you got to take these things seriously. You can't, you know, you can't say, oh, it's not going to happen to me. It's secure, because it can, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, it's everything's going to be fine. Yeah, famous last words.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yep, yep. As one of my teachers once said, oh, I can have unprotected sex. Nothing's going to happen to me. Well, that's how a lot of people get STDs and pregnant, so...
Exactly.
I mean, it reminds me of how, of the gay folks I know, who are, like, really young and stuff, they're actually, like, super paranoid about, like, getting STDs and stuff. And I'm told that, yeah, the people who are actually getting the STDs actually aren't the young and gay men. It's, if you can believe this, it's actually senior citizens.
Too much information. But it happens. It does happen, you know.
But anyway, back to the story. Now, Virginia is now looking at paying about $130,000 per machine to replace them. And they're going to have to train people on how to use the new systems before the next election, which is in June. So, yeah.
Wow. Your taxpayers at work.
Tax dollars at work.
Well, not to mention, not only are they easy to hack, I've also heard, you know, the voting machines themselves aren't very accurate. Like, I remember reading there was one guy, you know, who tried to vote for, I think it was John Kerry, but it ended up clicking on someone else, you know, by accident because of a screen problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, these things aren't open source. They aren't independently audited.
That reminds me of, like, a bunch of different criteria you said that basically said, okay, here's, you know, like, the minimum... that you would accept for, like, you know, fully electronic voting machines. I remember one of them was open source, open audited.
Open source.
I think another was that it has to have, like, a hard copy, like a punch card or something backup.
Right, yeah, for verification. And the third one was it can be connected to nothing.
Exactly, yeah.
No Wi-Fi, no network. Put a Faraday cage around the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the minimum you would have to do to get me behind an electronic voting machine. Otherwise, I like what my county does. I've got the cardstock thing. It's got the two little arrows. I just use the pen to complete the arrow. And
yeah, where do you live again?
North Carolina.
Oh.
Yeah, I live in Maryland myself. And for us, we use, like, the touchscreen system. I mean, it's decent, I guess, but whatever.
I live in Wisconsin. For the most part, we still use, you know, the traditional, you know, here's a piece of paper, fill out, you know, the bar of who you want to vote for. Yeah, some of the options you vote for, you know, you don't even have a lot of options. Like county sheriff, there's only one guy there, so what's the point, you know? It's like, yeah. You know, the county sheriff might as well be appointed because, you know, I mean, yeah, he's elected, but who runs for county sheriff, you know, for the most part, unless you're a diehard, you know, seeker of a law enforcement career, you know?
Yeah, I always see that too, and I'm thinking like, okay, yeah, I can vote for this guy in this obscure local position, but there's only one choice, so I mean... what's the point?
We actually had a libertarian last year run against the only sheriff on the ballot, but he had to do it as a write-in candidate, so...
Of course.
If you're on the Wi-Fi in a coffee shop or hotel, anyone on that network can get your traffic. Do you really trust all of those strangers? For that matter, do you really trust your ISP? A VPN can protect you from prying eyes, disguise your location, and even foil government sensors. It's essential in this day and age. So go to vpn.pagosity.tv and you'll be taken to BoxPN. Starting at just $2.99 a month, you can get unlimited high-speed connections to VPN servers all over the world. And they don't log connections, so your privacy is assured. Traveling abroad, just VPN home, and don't worry about what those other governments are doing. Back at home, stop your ISP from traffic shaping and messing with the quality internet access you're paying good money for. You can connect from multiple machines at once, including your smartphone or tablet, and it supports all the secure standards, including OpenVPN and SSTP. Bypass sensors and surveillance with your own secure VPN connection. Go to vpn.pagosity.tv.
Okay, you've just heard a promo for BoxPN, unless you're a patron, of course, and we've talked about VPNs in the past and how they're vital for things like if you're in a hotel or a Wi-Fi hotspot, or even if you just want to stop your ISP from doing things like traffic shaping. Just to recap, the idea is that you connect your computer to a VPN server somewhere else, and your connection to that computer is completely secure. anyone along the way, whether it's the other people at Starbucks or your ISP or whoever, all they see coming from your computer is just pseudo random noise. And they can't tell anything that you're doing. And then from that VPN server, it goes on to the destination as normal. So it's just that first leg of the journey that's encrypted. But it does allow you to protect from things like that. And another thing it allows you to do is get around geolocation restrictions. So if you're in a country that's censoring websites, you just VPN to a server in a different country, all those websites see your traffic as originating from that VPN server. So like if you're not in the US, you're on vacation somewhere else, but you want to watch Netflix, or you're not in the UK, but you want to watch iPlayer, or YouTube says that this video isn't available in your area, you can just VPN to the appropriate country, get a server there, and BoxVPN has servers all around the world, and you can just get right around those restrictions.
Oh, that would come in so much handy, because some of my favorite YouTube videos I can't watch anymore, because apparently Sony of Europe or whatever thinks that America's untrustworthy, so a lot of my favorite videos are blocked in the United States on copyright grounds, so yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. This is something that I'm kind of flabbergasted in now that I'm getting into the movie-making industry, because the thing you want to do is distribute your content. Well, if you're distributing, if you're doing commercials, if you're doing documentaries, things like that, distribution means get your content seen far and wide. If you're making a film or a TV show, it's weird. Distribution is as much about preventing people from seeing your content as it is getting it out.
Yeah.
It's really crazy, but I guess they're trying to make that artificial scarcity.
Great, if you go tell Sega how well that worked out for them, guys.
Oh, yeah, the whole Sega controversy, yeah.
Say, we've got a great idea to make money. Let's prevent people from buying our product. Yeah, that worked out.
And the funny thing was that Sega was blocking videos, you know, just for reviewing a game series that was from the Sega Genesis era and wasn't, you know, commercially available except for places like Amazon and eBay. You know, it's like, why even bother with that?
Well, guess what? The big media companies don't like it, and they want to ban VPN services as violations of copyright law.
Boo!
What? Oh, that is stupid. Again, that's why I hate copyright laws as much as I hate patent laws.
So this story is from New Zealand, and what's happened is ISPs in New Zealand started offering VPN services to their customers so that they could get around a lot of these geo-blocks. Well, about a week or so ago, there were a bunch of these organizations, Lightbox, MediaWorks, Sky, and TVNZ. They got together and threatened New Zealand ISPs that if they didn't stop offering these VPN services, then the media companies would sue them for copyright infringement.
Yeah, we are gonna sue you. That's the solution everyone says nowadays. Yep. Don't like someone, sue them.
Yeah. So here's what the letter said, quote, offshore providers such as Netflix US, Hulu, Amazon Prime, and BBC iPlayer do not have the right to exploit the copyright works in New Zealand. They're not doing anything!
Oh, there's that magical word, exploit.
But they're not even doing anything. Other people are connecting to their websites. They,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange how some people think, oh, you're providing a good or service that people want. You're exploiting them.
Yeah.
They say the exact same thing about Lyft and Uber.
Yeah, I exploit myself at least twice a day, but that's not even there.
Yeah, well, and they're also saying that, you know, these ISPs are granting them access to this copyrighted material that they say is infringing, but ISPs give you access to the entire internet. That's what they do. That's what they're for.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is crazy.
By their quote, logic, close quote, we should ban cars because they enable, or get rid of roads because they enable getaway vehicles.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this article mentions the Copyright Act of 1994, which sounds a lot like the DMCA here, and it makes it illegal for someone to circumvent copy protection. And I think we've talked about some of the idiocy of this in the past, but this is like when they tried to make a DVD player for the Linux operating system. In order to play a DVD, you have to decrypt it. But they said that the software they had written to decrypt it was getting around the copyright measures, which was the encryption, and so they couldn't even make a player without running afoul of these restrictions.
Oh, you mean like those area codes in DVD players?
No. This is different. This is actually an encryption key that encrypts the DVD. But the thing is, in order to play the DVD, whatever you're playing it on, your computer, your DVD player, or whatever, it has to decrypt it in order for you to watch it.
Oh.
And so that means that you, whatever it is, you've got the decryption keys right there on your computer.
Yeah, sorry if I sound clueless.
That's how DRM works, and it's just...
And they're trying to regulate that.
Because the whole point of encryption is you got to keep those keys secret. But with DRM, you have to give the customer the keys so that, yeah.
DRM, punishing the people who bought it legally.
They even said that getting around this geolocation was a violation of the terms and conditions of Netflix and all those others.
Oh.
I was like, what?
Come on, I barely understand those terms and services conditions, and I know that's bogus.
It's like the end user license agreement stuff. I mean, okay, seriously, who outside of maybe, I don't know, an IP law firm has ever read those whole things, for that matter, at least understood them? I mean, come on, give me a break. Yeah.
I think they've said the only parts of those that are valid are the ones that say, like, if their software causes your computer to explode or anything, they're not liable. But other than that, I don't think any of that's valid. Well, unfortunately, at least one ISP has caved, unlimited internet, and the director said, quote, "Geo-unblocking services are a direct result of consumer demand for access to content that is not made available to the New Zealand market. To be on the safe side, we have taken legal advice on this matter, and I have made a firm call that we will sit on the sideline until a legal precedent has been set." So they're just stopping doing it for the time being until it gets all sorted out in the courts. Fortunately, though, two others, Call Plus and Bypass Network Services, have said they have no intention of caving in. Bypass CEO Patrick Jordan Smith said, quote, "To receive without warning a grossly threatening legal letter like that from four of the largest companies in New Zealand is not something we are used to. It smacks of bullying, to be honest, especially since your letter doesn't actually say why you think we are breaching copyright." He called them a, quote, "gang," and also said, quote, "Your letter gets pretty close to the speculative invoicing type letters that lawyers for copyright owners sometimes send in the U.S., pay up or shut down or else we're going to sue you. Not fair. We have been providing the Global Mode facility for 2 years. In all that time, none of your big media gang have ever written to us. We assumed they were okay with Global Mode, and we continue to spend money innovating the facility and providing innovative New Zealand ISPs with a service that their customers were telling them they wanted, a service that lets people pay for content rather than pirate it."
Which, I thought that was what they wanted, from them to pay for it instead of pirate it. Like, okay, what's the problem? What, their cut isn't even bigger? Grief.
But kudos for them for fighting back, because that is a stance that we need to be taking on these, because, you know, patent trolls, copyright trolls, they're all the same. They need to be stopped.
Do you want answers to creationist claims against evolution? Would you like to know more about evolution yourself, or even engage creationists more directly with actual peer-reviewed sources to back you up? My book, How Evolution is Scientific, is designed to show the basics of evolutionary theory and how it is so well supported using the scientific method. It's impeccably sourced, with references to the actual scientific material, and is arranged using the creationists' own criteria of what is scientific. Using their own arguments against them, see how evolution is scientific, but creationism is not. Based on observations, accurate predictions, logic, and evidence. Get answers to common creationist claims, and even a primer on abiogenesis, the start of all life. It's all in my book, How Evolution is Scientific, available at Amazon and on Kindle, EPUB, and PDF as well. Get How Evolution is Scientific and never be taken in by creationists again.
And now let's regress the analysis of this week's biggest bogon emitter.
Ooh, my favorite part.
And this week it goes to Thomas Piketty, who made lots of bogus claims about inequality in the United States, which politicians and pundits love to use to support their agenda, but that falls apart when examined, as Philip Magnus found and reported in The Freeman. Quote, "The centerpiece of Piketty's inequality argument is a sweeping historical narrative of the 20th century, ostensibly rooted in data." And the quick summary is, he starts off looking at the conditions in the Gilded Age. He goes through the destruction caused by the two world wars and the Great Depression. And then he said, quote, "The result was a stabilizing period during which the wealth distribution for most of the developed world converged at a much lower level of inequality from roughly the 1950s through the 1970s. This all changed, according to Piketty, around 1980, when a series of tax reforms tied to Ronald Reagan in the United States and Margaret Thatcher in Britain disassembled the mid-century progressive tax regimes. Inequality, he contends, has been on the rise ever since. The only problem is, he got there by cherry-picking.
Doesn't surprise me.
And here's the thing. Okay, let's say that he was right with that stuff. Very well. But then there's also the fact that, okay, yeah, fine, but for one, the Great Depression, which he talks about, hurting equality or whatever, was a government thing.
Were the two world wars.
It would not have lasted that long if it wasn't for government.
Yeah.
And two, can people please stop talking about the 80s as, that's when they slashed taxes and everything. Yeah, while government, I think, doubled or tripled in size? Give me a break.
Oh, yeah. Revenues increased dramatically. The deficits increased dramatically.
Oh, yeah. And not to mention, the thing that really just kills me when I bring up, the whole income inequality, a common argument they bring up is, well, look at the income inequality. Doesn't it bother you that the top, 10, 1, whatever percentage they use, has like all this money while you don't? And the rich are getting richer, but just look at the quality of life of the poor. I went to high school with a lot of poor kids and they all had access to a computer, a television, a game system, and a car, and they lived in trailer parks, and yet they still had internet. They still had a lot of stuff that, middle-class people had, heck, they even had iPhones. Some of them had even better phones than I had.
An example I know Shane's given at some point was, there were diseases 100 years, and infections or what have you, 100 years ago that would have killed the richest person, that even the poorest people can get a cure or whatever for only $4 in Walmart's pharmacy. So, you have to look at the absolute terms as well. Like, and I know the example he would give that I just love throwing out because it's just that awesome is like, okay, so if I make 20 grand a year and you make 100 grand a year, we're both still better off if we each make 10 grand a year.
So there are like five different sources he used to make this graph. Like one went up to, I think, 1950, and then another for the 60s and so on. And he shows all of this. And that's how you get that U-shaped graph that he makes this big deal about, that Paul Krugman and everyone used to throw in the face, say, you're inequality deniers, here's the proof. Well, what he did was, what Magnus did, he reconstructed it a different way. So in the original graph, it starts high in 1910, goes down to about World War II, and stays low until 1980, and then goes back up. But all Magnus did, was change at which point he moved from one metric to the other, and he got it to tell exactly the opposite story. He actually got it to show inequality rising through the 60s up to 1980, and then falling after 1980. Just by choosing a different point at which to switch over to the other metrics.
And of course, I can guarantee that if there were any other field of science, he would be laughed at, kicked out, and shamed, and rightly so.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's just the sad thing about economics. Economics is, in a sense, it's a science. It's kind of like mathematics, yet it's not taken seriously, sadly,
So basically like astronomy back in Galileo's days, basically.
Oh, yeah.
And what Magnus says is, quote, he seems to construct most of his data presentations around a specific historical narrative that he has already embraced as correct. That is an inversion of scientific inquiry, placing the cart of an ideological conclusion before the data horse, and in some cases, selectively ignoring or admitting data points that diverge from that conclusion. You're supposed to, it's like that editorial cartoon about the evolutionary scientist says, here's the data, what conclusions can we draw from it? And the creationist has the Bible and says, here's our conclusions, what data can we find to support it? It's no different.
Breaking Sherlock Holmes' first rule, as Hawkeye would say.
It actually also reminds me of another little interesting thing I read. It was about, there was a study done on obesity, and there was one famous scientist, the guy who proposed the lipid hypothesis, which, by the way, you'd be surprised, has largely been debunked, but guess what? He people were wondering, well, if that's, not the cause for all of our health problems, then why does this data show, people with high cholesterol diet get heart attacks and cancer? And it turns out the scientist who proposed that theory, he nitpicked the data. He picked countries, where there was a lot of cholesterol and high heart attacks, but he ignored, countries, where they ate a lot of cholesterol but had little to no heart attacks, and countries that didn't eat a whole lot of cholesterol but still had a lot of high heart attacks. you know, one person actually took all the countries, and when you look at the graph, it actually went all over the place.
In other words, roughly zero correlation, which sounds like what I've learned, since Shane can probably, and then can tell you I'm a bit of a health buff on this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not healthy to be, you know, very fat, but at the same time, you know, being fat isn't a death sentence like a lot of people say it is.
It's a part of the overall picture is what it is.
Well, it's not even that. It's the thing about the eating dietary cholesterol thing. I mean, I remember Menno Henselmans even presenting a study noting that, yeah, actually, even if you already have heart disease, eggs, for example, are actually, even the egg yolk is still healthy for you. But going back to the actual data itself, I look at this and notice the inequality, at least I'm assuming that, yeah, okay, so yeah, top 1% of share in the US, by the actual data, not what he cherry-picked, seems to have spiked around, you know, the gilded era, and then basically went down in the, during the Great Depression, so I think, yay, we're all equally miserable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the next thing I think is, looking back at the analysis of the data that you did, Shane, during the microcosm fallacy video, I think, what that tells me is, if anything, that number would be even lower, as we don't have more people being bailed out, and cronies getting even fatter, courtesy of GovCo, and their barriers to entry and the like.
Exactly. And all of that makes Thomas Piketty this week's biggest bogon emitter. Hackers. Terrorists. The NSA. But I repeat myself. Your online security is under attack, and the weakest point is your password. That's why you need LastPass. LastPass plugs into your browser and allows you to randomly generate strong, unique passwords anywhere on the web, all protected by one master password. LastPass sets up in minutes and gives you secure automatic logins throughout the web, synchronizing across all your browsers and all your computers, at home, at work, or on the road. It even securely stores sensitive form data, including credit card numbers. Backup sensitive documents, membership info, Wi-Fi logins, and more. And with LastPass Premium, you can get these benefits on other applications and even mobile devices, and also get priority customer support. Sign up at password.pagosity.tv for a free month of LastPass Premium. Log in securely everywhere using the last password you'll ever have to remember. Go to password.pagosity.tv and get LastPass now. And now it's time to junk the science of this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire!
And this week, it goes to Lisa Wade, who made the incredible claim that people who actually understand economics are selfish, antisocial, and all-around bad people. Her article is titled, Are Economic Majors Antisocial? And the first sentence in the article is simply, Yep.
Professionalism.
Oh my God. And that's the reason why so many modern economics worship Paul Krugman today.
And people wonder why most of us regular folk don't take people in the academic bubble seriously. Like, I actually read this article and I'm basically just laughing like, okay, look at the stuff, the quote-unquote study she is talking about. Like, how it only asked if you would only donate to her personal favorite liberal political groups.
And well, this wasn't done by Wade, I should say. It was done by economists Joram Bowman and Elena Rose. And what they asked was if they would like to donate to WASH PIRG, which is described as a left-leaning public interest group, and ATN, which is a lobbying group that wants to reduce tuition rates, presumably by increasing government taxes. And so they crunched this data along with the majors and classes, and what they found was that econ majors were less likely to donate to either cause, and non-econ majors who had taken econ classes were less likely to donate than non-majors who hadn't.
I mean, can you imagine if, say, a bunch of young Earth creationists got together and pulled something like this, only instead it was, would you donate to, say, the Catholic Church, Westboro Baptist Church, or insert name of other church here, and then debunked it based on, like, I don't know, a religion, and then said, aha, see, so if you're a major in science, or if you're an atheist, that means you're more likely to be a bad person who, you know, you hate the poor, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, correlation does not equal causation. In fact, I actually, when I read that article, that actually reminded me of another interesting, you know, example of correlation does not equal causation that a friend of mine told me, which is, did you know that Americans are more likely to get into car accidents than North Koreans? Now, by her logic, that would mean, oh, then that must mean the North Koreans are careful and safe drivers. Nope, the real reason is because almost no one in North Korea owns a car.
Exactly. My favorite is, if you look at ice cream sales and you look at drownings, they go up and down together. Ice cream must cause drownings.
Oh, and the murder rate. Don't forget that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was also that one website that lets you see the correlation versus causation, and there was one
spurious correlations. Yep. Love it. Silver Kluon winner.
I think I actually went on that website one time, and it said something like, when Nicolas Cage movies make a lot of money, more Wisconsinites eat cheese.
That is just awesome.
Yeah, all sorts of crazy things. But, I mean, when you have things like the purpose of the ice cream and the drowning was to just show how it's an incorrect cause, the reason why there's a correlation there is because people eat more ice cream when it's hotter, and people go swimming when it's hotter.
Yep.
But it's not just the correlation-causation fallacy that's at play here. Using nothing more than this data, Wade concludes, quote, "Econ majors are less likely to share, less generous to the needy, and more likely to cheat, lie, and steal."
Classy.
Yeah, because non-econ majors don't do that.
Well, but yeah. I mean, it's just asking them about those two groups. That has nothing to do with sharing. Neither of those charities help the needy, and it has nothing to do with lying, cheating, and stealing.
Oh, yeah, you know.
I mean, they didn't ask if they'd like to donate to, say, Doctors Without Borders. There were no conservative or libertarian or even completely apolitical charities mentioned, and yet they're drawing all these crazy conclusions from it.
Yeah, not to mention, even if they were apolitical, it still wouldn't matter because, you know, just because you don't donate to charity doesn't mean you're not social. It just means, you know, you either don't have the money or you just don't think the charities you're offered are reliable, you know.
Or maybe, just maybe, people who have a greater understanding of economics know things that she doesn't, which is you can't solve a problem just by throwing money at it. So they may be more reluctant to donate to any charity on the fly that they just hear about without learning anything about it first and looking them up on Charity Navigator or whatever.
Oh yeah, that is true. The truth is, you know, I mean, as we love to portray, you know, giving to charity as being nice, but the sad truth is that a good majority of charity organizations, now I'm not trashing them or anything, but a good majority of them, you know, when you give them money, it's not going to the cause you think you're going to. It's going to pretty much just funding the charity, you know.
And not to mention how, okay, but what if I don't have money to donate, but what if I'd rather donate my time or my blood? Or in fact, I'm actually an organ donor as well.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you don't need to give money to donate to charity. There's many ways you can donate, you know. I remember seeing this one charity group where they actually will, I forgot what it was called, but it's basically this company that tries to fund small businesses in third world countries. And the way they do it is they donate, you know, small utilities like cooking pots, some sewing machines and all that. So like cooks or sewer workers in the third world, they can open up their own, you know, little businesses.
Yep. I'm also reminded of that one study. I think it was, or not a study, but I think it was a poll done by ABC, I think it was, where it showed that conservatives donate something like 3 times more to charity than liberals, and libertarians donate even more than that.
And here's the thing, when we donate, people, you know, in my experience, you know, people with economic training, when we do donate, we tend to donate more wisely. You know, we don't just give them, you know, our donations to, you know, whatever group, you know, tugs at our hearts. We actually will investigate the group, you know, figure out if they're worth the donation.
In other words, we're not just going to go by our feels. We understand that this thing, this science called economics, and that, yeah, it all comes back to economics.
Yeah.
And the results, not intentions.
Yeah, this reminds me when I went to high school, because I went to high school in 2012, and that was during the big, you know, Coney 2012 thing, you know, and everyone was saying, you got to donate, you got to buy it. Then I did my own investigation and found out that not only was the charity organization unreliable, the cause it was fighting for, Joseph Kony, he wasn't even active at the time. In fact, he hasn't been active since 2003, and the Ugandan authorities believe he's probably most likely, you know, on his deathbed right now.
Yeah, he was completely not a problem at that time.
I even saw this one video game animation channel making fun of that, and it was like, yeah, it's like, but we gotta stop them. Is that the bad guy from Star Wars? Yeah, you remember that one.
Oh, yeah, and then it ends with like that guy, you know, who funded going, hey, it looks like our profits weren't invisible, you know. Yeah, you know, most of the money went to the guy who founded the organization, you know, so.
Yep.
But perhaps going back to the article, I mean, it's like, what also killed me was by the end of it, it's like, well, they need to take balance and classes, ones that present a different kind of economics.
Right.
Okay, where have I heard this before?
Well, we should present a balance to astronomy where the sun goes around the earth.
Oh, yeah.
Or we need to teach the controversy. Let the students decide, yeah. You know, between evolution and creationism.
Teach the controversy, yep.
Yeah. Oh, I hate that argument, you know. Yeah, I'm all for debating and all that, but there's a difference between, you know, presenting an argument and teaching it, you know.
Yeah, tell me more about how colleges aren't assaulting indoctrination centers again. I mean, between the thing with the third grader earlier and this crap, and the other stories we covered, good lord.
Well, and she closes out, quote, "Being exposed to a variety of views, including ones that question the premises of neoclassical economics, may be one way to make economists more honest and kind. And doing so isn't just about sticking one to econ, it's an issue of grave seriousness, as the criminal and immoral behavior of our financial leaders is exactly what triggered a great recession once and could again."
Oh my God.
I guess her actually learning something about economics to know how incredibly wrong her last sentence is would be horrible, since learning how reality really operates makes you immoral.
Because if there's any one policy and mindset behind the world's largest government in history, it's free markets.
Yeah. Why don't we listen to the economists who actually predicted the financial crisis?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry for the harsh language. It's just that, look, you know, going back, I used to, you know, when I was a part of this one group and I was debating communists a lot, you know, one reason why I flat out stopped debating with them, you know, wasn't because I was narrow-minded. It's because even the smart ones on that site, none of them knew, you know, part of my language, jack shit about economics. You know, they were all about the feels and all that. I mean, there was one guy who flat out said the best way we can implement communism is we got to find a way to get rid of economics altogether. How do you get rid of an economy?
Sure, no problem. Just starve everybody. No economy, no people, no exchange, and they're all dead.
Not to mention, I actually posted some of your videos, you know, explaining, you know, how to argue for that, and they fell into all the traps, you know, whenever I told them, look, you know, if you're going to argue for communism, you need to tell me what communism has over the current one we have. What did they do? Instead, they said, well, look what capitalism did and all that. You know, it's like, that's not what I'm asking you.
But I guess we're just horrible people for understanding why Lisa Wade deserves to be named this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire!
Well, that wraps up this "He Learned Almost Too Late That Man Is a Feeling Creature" edition of the Bogosity Podcast. As always, you can come to forum.bogosity.tv to read the show notes and join the discussion. This podcast depends on you to keep going, so please donate using the links on the website or at patreon.bogosity.tv. And feel free to join in by sending a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. You can even stick it in an audio file if you want. Thank you for listening, and thanks again to Travis Retriever and Chris Hangartner for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Yep.
Until next time, here's a quote from Joan Robinson. "The purpose of studying economics is not to acquire a set of ready-made answers to economic questions, but to learn how to avoid being deceived by economists." Mm-hmm. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 imported license.
Bogosity.
Hello, everyone. You know, we talked for quite a bit longer. We digressed in a few places and we talked a bit after the podcast. Ordinarily, this is where I'd stick them right here on the end, but this time it was just so long, I thought I'd put it in a separate after show. So please look for that in the next couple of days, and thank you for listening.